This is XTP Media.
He needed someone who was prepared to risk his neck. Anthony Fokker was prepared to risk his neck. They built about 300 ultra-modern fighters that equipped the Soviet Air Force.
Yeah.
which was something that nobody in Holland knew. A test pilot par excellence. He could fly an airplane and immediately sense what was wrong with it.
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. Ready for takeoff. So, here are your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 82 of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Today, I'm joined by Mark Derricks, a senior researcher at the Huygens Institute of the Royal Netherlands Academy of Arts and Sciences. Mark has published 15 books on the history of aviation, air transport, and other topics. Today, though, we're going to talk about his latest book, Anthony Fokker, The Flying Dutchman Who Shaped American Aviation. Mark talks to us about how he researched the book and the challenges he faced, and then we talk about the life of Anthony Fokker, a really fascinating character. At the end, we get an exclusive, so stay tuned. Mark, welcome to Extended.
Thank you. I'm glad to be on your show.
And you're talking to us from Holland today, aren't you? You've had a busy
That's
week.
That's right, yeah.
But whereabouts are you in the Netherlands?
I'm in the south of the country, in a town called 's-Hertogenbosch.
Yep.
It's a very old medieval town.
Right, okay. Now, before we get to talk about Anthony Fokker and the book The Flying Dutchman Who Shaped American Aviation, you're a very prolific author. You've produced quite a lot of aviation content before. Tell us a little bit about your background before writing this particular book.
Well, I'm a historian by profession. And although my actual specialty in within history is the history of international relations, I've always had an academic hobby, and my academic hobby is the history of aviation. And indeed, I did write quite a few books that relate to that.
And you've also written about Fokker before, haven't you?
Yeah, the subject won't go away.
Right, okay. Oh, well, maybe we can come back and talk a little bit about some of your other publications later on. But before we talk about the book itself and about the enigma that was Anthony Fokker, this was a very challenging book to write. Tell us how you went about it.
Well, it was a very challenging book because the life of my protagonist played out in different continents. He was born in the Dutch East Indies on the island of Java, then moved to the Netherlands, moved to Germany, moved back to Holland, moved to the United States, but spent quite a bit of his time in Switzerland as well. So my research really was not just a research about a guy, but also research about various places where his life evolved.
Yeah, okay. And I suppose it's fair to say that although Fokker himself is almost a worldwide brand still to this very day, there wasn't much academic or written material for you to go back and research, was there?
Well, there was some. He had his autobiography written in 1930 and 1931 by an American journalist, Bruce Gold. And that was a bestseller in its days. It was published in, I think, 7 or 8 different languages, and is being reprinted, at least the German edition is, to this very day. So it's not as if there was nothing.
Yeah.
But the autobiography is a very strange book by itself, because normally when you have a translation from a book, the content is the same, right? You know, you have a text and you write it in a different language. But in the case of Fokker, the translations deviate. Some books have stories that other language versions do not have.
Right, okay. All right. Well, that doesn't help, does it?
Well, it doesn't, but it does at the same time, because in my case, I discovered the discrepancies between the various language editions, and that brought me a little closer to the guy himself, and to why he wanted to have some elements of his life story in some language present, but perhaps not in others.
Right. Yes, that is quite interesting. And having read the book, I understand now. I understand the angle that you're coming from, because, as you said, he lived in different countries, and as we'll probably find out in his story, there were reasons for him not wanting certain items to be made aware in those countries.
Exactly. Yeah.
And you also had access to some letters that he wrote to his mother as well, didn't you?
Yeah. What Fokker left to posterity, at least what his mother left, because he didn't really leave anything behind. But his mother had collected the various letters that he wrote to her as a young guy when he was sort of trying to get started into aviation and was living in Germany. And those are about 28 letters. And that was really all we knew of his own writings. But because of my bizarre academic hobby in aviation history, I stumbled across the figure Fokker in various archives, not just in Holland, but in Germany, in the UK, in the United States, well, practically everywhere the man traveled.
Yeah.
And in the course of various researches on different topics, I took notes whenever the name Fokker propped up. And so that's how I compiled part of the story. There's a long story that's also quite fascinating in its own right, how I found out about some of the elements of the story by chance encounters when I was located in Washington. I used to be connected to the Smithsonian Institution for a while, and I once in a queue to queuing up for sandwiches over lunch, I got talking to an elderly gentleman who, in the end, to make a long story short, told me that 40 years before he'd gotten stuck in a taxi in New York and got talking to the taxi driver, who had a neighbor who had just died the week before that, a German lady who had no children, no next of kin, and had asked the taxi driver if he could look after her worldly possessions after she passed away. And among her worldly possessions were a set of photo albums with letters and cards included in it. And they were from Anthony Fokker, because lo and behold, she'd been in love with him.
Wow. Wow.
Now, what are the chances that, you know, you cross the Atlantic, you're in line for your sandwich, you happen to strike up conversation with someone, and he is in possession of a whole set of documents that throw a really different light on the private life of your main protagonist.
Wow.
Now, it doesn't get much better than that.
No, it doesn't. Now, let's go on to his story and the book itself. It's a beautiful book. It's very, very detailed. It's a rich biography. And there has been a lot written about Fokker by other authors. What was your inspiration for writing this particular account?
Well, I really got interested into Fokker very early on in my academic career, because at that point I was trying to make a sort of a tour around the country. And although that Holland is of course a small country, touring is can take quite a bit of time. But I tried to make a tour around the country, trying to find out what various businesses had left in the sense of archives. And I went to the Fokker Company, which was still in existence then. This is about 30 years ago, just to give you an idea how long I've spent on my guy. This was about 30 years ago, and I went to visit the company secretary. And he told me that, well, if you're interested in Fokker, you know, you're not going to find much, because we gave away our archive in 1946 to the Amsterdam Fire Brigade for fire practices. I went, what? Why? He said, well, you know, in 1940, before the war, Fokker had about 1,000 people working at the factory. In 1945, when our country was liberated from the Germans, there were about 6,000 people working for Fokker. And the 5,000 that went in left all kinds of traces that the post-war factory management and the government did really not want to keep.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. It's a fascinating story, and I could spend probably hours talking to you about this research, but let's start talking about the man himself. As you mentioned, he was born in the Dutch East Indies, but he was born into a relatively affluent family, wasn't he? He certainly wasn't from a poor environment.
No, not at all. His family had accumulated a vast fortune in the centuries before his time. His family is from the southwest of the country, and they earned their money in the trade with the Dutch East Indies.
Yeah.
His father, who was, of course, who inherited part of the family wealth, spent about 185,000 guilders, which was a tremendous sum of money at the turn of the 20th century, on the hobby of his son.
Yeah.
So you're really talking about people who belong to the top notch of the Dutch society.
And he was absolutely obsessed with flying from the off, wasn't he? But we have to remember, flying at the turn of the century, as it was very, very new. The Wright brothers had obviously had their maiden flight, and aviation was spreading around the world. But it was a very, very dangerous sport at that time, wasn't it?
Yeah, the average life expectancy of somebody who attained their flying license was between 4 and 8 months before you crashed, and you only crashed once and you didn't live to tell about it. Mm. Anthony Fokker, on the contrary, crashed 8 times. And you have to imagine that, you know, somebody, you climb up the church tower and you fall down and you survive. But you go back up again and again and again. And this is one of the things that really struck me about the character, that he must have been a diehard, persevering guy, because normally you wouldn't even think of going on, not in, but on a plane.
Yeah. And certainly one of his first accidents actually killed his passenger from memory as well. So as you say,
that was after he'd survived 3 or 4 crashes without passengers. So.
Right. Okay. He certainly was a lucky character as people fell beside him. But how did he start to get involved in manufacturing? He went to Germany first, didn't he?
Yeah, that was not a sort of a, that was not a normal course to follow in the first place. obviously. He went to Germany as a young guy, and before that, he went to school in Holland. His family moved back from the Dutch East Indies. But he was a very poor pupil and always came back just about last in his class. He didn't even finish his high school education. And by the time his father got fed up with him in the summer of 1910, he decided to send his son to Germany because his father had spent some of his youth in Germany getting a diploma. And since Anthony had displayed an interest in mechanical things, dad decided that Anthony was going to be a car mechanic. And that's how he ended up in Germany, because in Germany you could get an education in car mechanics even though you didn't have a high school diploma.
Yeah, and remembering even automobiles at that time were still in their infancy, let alone aircraft. But his passion for flight just never left, did it? And he eventually found a way of getting involved with flying through his studies.
Yeah, well, you can't even call it studies, but he arrived in Germany, and he didn't like this auto mechanic training, and he managed to get into organize things in such a way that he was admitted to a 6-week course in aviation technology. And that was really not leading up to any kind of diploma. It was not even an official kind of curriculum, but it was something that one of the vocational training facilities in Mainz in Germany did on the side.
Yeah.
And those 6 weeks really taught Anthony Fokker all he knew about aviation and about the technologies of aviation, which is really strange when you think of that, you know, in our own day and age, when you study aeronautical engineering, you need at least 6 years.
And it was in its infancy, and there were lots of new startup businesses and airframes, and he quickly cottoned on to the opportunity to use an airframe for his own needs, didn't he? And his father was bankrolling him at this very early stage with very substantial investments.
Yeah, he was lucky in the sense that the 6-week training course that he went to had been around for a couple years before that, and the previous bunches of pupils had constructed their own aircraft. Some were after French designs, after the Farman design. But they'd also constructed something of their own designs. But by the time Anthony Fokker almost completed his 6-week course, the German authorities decided that they were not going to have these foreign pupils fly over the German defense fortresses.
Yeah.
And they closed down this vocational facility. And Anthony, with one of his fellow students, bought the plane that they had been working on. And that was really how he got into, how he later on imagined that he'd become an aeronautical constructor, although the construction itself was practically finished when he and his partner Franz von Daun bought it.
And he in effect became test pilot and pilot as well. How did his flying skills evolve through these early stages of aircraft design and manufacture?
Well, his partner was a German lieutenant who'd retired from the army. He was the guy who was bankrolling the aircraft and the engine, but he needed someone who was prepared to risk his neck. Anthony Fokker was prepared to risk his neck, hoping that he would be able to become a pilot in the process.
Yeah.
So the two of them bought the only airplane of the school that was up for sale. and finished it or got it finished, employing various specialists, woodworkers, and an aeronautical engineer who was who ran a small business in the same vicinity. They finished the airplane, and Anthony, in early 1911, managed to actually fly it. So that's how he became a pilot, yeah. And then obtained his flying license.
And he became single-minded, didn't he, about flying? I couldn't quite pick out from the story whether it was the passion of flying or whether, as you mentioned earlier, the sheer determination that this man, this very young man at this time, had to be a pilot. It was very glamorous, as we know, in his early flying years, he attracted attention of the opposite sex quite quickly, and I think he quite liked that. But that didn't work out for him either. What, you know, looking back, do you think he was passionate about flying, or was it his business objectives that really drove him to become such an accomplished pilot?
No, he was absolutely passionate about flying. Flying was his life, all of it, really. Hmm. And the fact that he had such a troubled personal life with lady friends who all left him was really due to the fact that there was flying that came first, and then there was a very large void, and only then were other people sort of on the outskirts of his usual existence. And well, the various lady friends that he tried to get the attention of really didn't like that very much after the first few days or weeks.
Yeah, and I think it's fair to say as well that he wasn't too good at running the business of flying, because he was using that to raise money to teach others so that he could reinvest it in manufacturing more aircraft. But even in those early days, he was not a great businessman, was he?
No. He hadn't got a clue about how to run a business in the first place. And that maybe that came with the family also. I don't know, because his father was not a very successful businessman either. But his father pretended at least to know about accounting and things connected to that. And he kept sort of bugging his son that he had to take more care in being cautious with the funds that daddy supplied.
Yeah.
But it was really a very unsuccessful businessman in the first few years. Hmm. And if it hadn't been for the First World War to break out, we would never have heard of him.
Yeah.
he would have crashed and died at some point.
Yeah, he didn't have a long life expectancy along the route he was traveling. But he did eventually start producing aircraft, didn't he? And eventually got to sell some to the German army.
Yeah, which was very strange in itself, because would you buy an airplane from a 24-year-old guy without any kind of diploma?
But was this Mark all about the man, though? Because what he was very good at was convincing people. He was tenacious, and when he saw a deal, he didn't let go of it, did he?
That's right. Yeah. He was absolutely tenacious. I mean, he didn't care if he lived or died, as long as he could fly.
Hmm. And he started to, I suppose, from those first few aircraft sales, to get himself a factory, and eventually more orders started creeping in. But as he grew, I think one of the first traits that I noticed was that he wasn't always honest with his designs, was he? And don't get me wrong, he was certainly a great aircraft designer.
That I don't know, that the latter part, if he was a great aircraft designer. I'd be prepared put a few question marks there.
Right, okay. Let's talk about some of those early aircraft then that plagiarized, shall we say.
Yeah, fine.
He copied the Marine, didn't he? The Saulnier, the Type H that
used. Yeah. That was his first, well, that, in fact, as I explained, he started out with a design that he bought from this vocational training. He developed planes from that because he didn't have much technical knowledge. His aircraft did not really evolve very much in a technical sense or a technological sense of the way. But by 1913, he'd been invited to set up a flight training school in Schwerin in northern Germany, where they had a city council that was very much hoping that Schwerin, which didn't have any industry to speak of, might become a large aeronautical center in the world. And to achieve that goal, they created an airfield there. But if you have an airfield, you need to have flight. And the mayor of Schwerin set out to Berlin, where Anthony Fokker and others were at that point working, and tried to persuade various aeronautical constructors and pilots to set up business. And Fokker was the only one who wanted. And why? Because the city council in Schwerin was willing to put up the bill.
Yeah.
They gave him the use of the airport practically for free. They built specialized facilities for his latest hobby, building water, building float planes. So he, you know, he got an airfield for himself, basically, plus a factory, all with money from the local government. And then he was really lucky, because in October 1913, he got a very special customer for his flight training school, the grandson of the Iron Chancellor Bismarck in Germany, Alexander von Bismarck. And Alexander, only 16 years old, was, like Anthony Fokker, determined to risk his neck in becoming a pilot. But Alexander didn't just want to become a pilot. No, he wanted to have his own race airplane. And Anthony Fokker didn't have one, didn't know how to construct one, but Bismarck knew a way to get one, because he'd learned that in Paris, a French Morane had gone down, and the wreckage was for sale for only 500 marks, really a bargain. And the two of them worked out that if they would buy the wreckage, transport it to Germany and take it apart, then maybe they would learn the secret of the Morane, which was then a very technologically advanced plane. And this is how Anthony Fokker, as one of the first airplane producers in Germany, became aware of the latest technologies employed by the French.
From across the globe, from the center of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society has a range of specialist groups which focus on a specific domain or discipline. They form a vital interface between the society and the world at large, and serve both the interests of enthusiasts and professionals through debate, conferences, lectures, and other activities. Learn how you can get involved. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
And he took it one step further, and even though he was a Dutch citizen, Dutch by birth, to sell to the German military, and of course the outbreak of the war was a great opportunity for Anthony Fokker. He applied to become a German citizen so that he could do business, didn't he?
Yeah, that was, of course, a bit of a problem when you're at war as a nation. You want to be sure that your major defense in industries will support your war causes, and of course the Germans had the same had that, just like the British had in the First World War also, and they very quickly after the outbreak of the war began pressurizing foreign businesses to become more German. And one of the ways that they did that was to appoint a German supervisor for each factory, or ask politely but insistently that the major director would become a national of the German Reich. And Anthony Fokker immediately said yes. He understood very clearly, and I think somebody must have whispered in his ear or something.
Yeah.
This was indeed something that he could not say no to. So between December 1914, when he got a letter from Berlin, and April 1915, when the formalities were finally finished, he very quickly became a German national.
And I think it's fair to say that most individuals around the world recognize the name Fokker from the First World War. And the 1418 war was a great opportunity for Anthony Fokker to grow his business, to develop his products. And I suppose the saying, he made hay while the sun shone, really applied to him. He wasn't great at business, but what he was great at was getting ideas, getting aircraft designed and getting them sold. And none more so than, of course, the triplane. But also he had great success with synchronized guns, in terms of, taking that idea and applying it to his aircraft. But it wasn't his idea, was it? And that haunted him for a long time.
No, it wasn't. It was never his own system. But even before the war started, there were attempts in various European countries to try and come up with guns that could be fitted on to aircraft so that you could take the war into the skies. And tests were being done in Russia, in Switzerland, in Germany, in Britain, in France, everywhere. But nobody really got the right system. But one of Fokker's competitors in Germany, a Swiss engineer called Franz Schneider, he'd come up with a basic synchronization system in 1913, and he had applied for a patent for this for his for his invention. Fokker must have known about this, and was tinkering with his own staff in trying to make this patent, which was a theoretical thing, work in actual practice. And early 1915, when the French experimented with more or less, well, not really synchronized gun, but at least guns that could fire from an airplane without destroying the plane itself, because you would hit the propeller in that case, there was a big incentive in Germany to come up with a better, or at least a competing system. And Fokker had it all ready by then, because his own engineer, Heinrich Lübbe, had by then worked out how to synchronize the gun by applying a notch on the propeller shaft.
Yeah,
a very basic, very simple idea, and you'd wonder why nobody else had actually thought of it before. But at least the Fokker invention worked.
Yeah,
but the patent was not his. The invention was not his. And Franz Schneider, who held the German patent, started a court case against him. And although Fokker lost every round of this court case in sequence for years, and the damages that they had to pay to Schneider went into the millions, he kept instructing his patent lawyers to stall the case, being convinced that finally, because the patent made him really rich.
Yeah,
that was when the real big money started flowing in. And he'd worked out that if he could just stall the court case long enough for his competitor to give up, then at the end of the process, the invention would be his.
Yeah.
It took him till 1933, but finally his big competitor, Franz Schneider, went into the poorhouse, partly also because of the legal cost of these endless court cases. And then in 1933, the invention was Fokker's.
And I think in many ways it proved he could also be quite ruthless as well.
Oh, yeah. But if you want to be successful in business, I think you have to be.
Yeah, I'm afraid so. Well, let's stick with the First World War and talk about the infamous triplane. Again, not his design, but he did enhance it, and what a successful aircraft that proved to be.
Yeah. Well, many of the stories of the Fokker designs have this strange treat to it.
Yeah.
And the triplane is no exception. In 1917, the Royal Navy squadrons operating over northern France and Belgium were the first to apply a new type of airplane, a triplane. And the advantage of a triplane is that by the extra wing surface that you have, the plane can actually climb faster. And in those days, the plane that was highest up in the sky had the best chances of surviving the dogfight.
Yeah.
So the triplane was seen as a terrific weapon by the Germans. And various aeronautical constructors received orders from the military authorities in Berlin to try and come up with a equal device, a plane that could match the Sopwith triplane. And the way his competitors went about this was to withdraw to the drawing board and start making their own calculations. But Anthony Fokker followed a different path, very typical of Fokker. He went to the front in southern Belgium, where his big friend Manfred von Richthofen was leading one of the crack German squadrons, and he stayed there just long enough for von Richthofen and his squadron to shoot down one of the Sopwith triplanes behind the German lines. And Fokker did what he had done in 1914. He took the plane apart, looked at all the design characteristics, drew his own conclusions. I can do better. Went back to Schwerin and built his own triplane and became legendary for it.
But it was quite challenging, wasn't it? They had some difficulties manufacturing, particularly the wings. And again, in this modern day and age, we have to go back to when this was all wooden, predominantly wooden and tubular construction. And curing the resin on the wings was a real problem.
Yeah, well, the Germans in the First World War, like in the Second War, they had a lot of problems, and scarcity of material was one of the dominant problems that was around in everyday life in Germany. And scarcity also meant scarcity of things like glue. Glue was difficult to come by. There was a lot of demand for natural glues. It was made from bones that were cooked, but the real thing about gluing airplane wings together, wooden wings, is that the glue was prone to humidity. It deteriorated when it got wet, and they knew about this. Fokker knew about this, and the way to go about preventing the glue to deteriorate would be to apply varnish to the various parts of the internal structure of a wing. But with the pressures of the war industry on Fokker, the people who worked for him in his factory were not always very careful in applying varnish. So it could just happen that they'd forgot to varnish parts of the wing, and then in front conditions where airplanes were mostly housed in tents on forward airfields, in after a couple of weeks or months, humidity would get the better of the internal structure of the wings, and they would just come off. And this was a particular problem that Fokker faced time and time again: quality control.
Yeah.
And it was only after planes started falling from the sky, even without the British firing on them, that they sent some really savvy technical people over to the front to examine what was actually going on, what was causing this.
And
then, of course, you know, quality control got better and better as more military personnel went into the factory to check on the actual production process.
Yeah, and the all this time, of course, Anthony and the Fokker business was growing. You mentioned some of his influential friends. He was a very strong networker.
He did things that nobody else did, that's what made his success in wartime Germany. Whereas all his competitors focused on, well, where are the orders for airplanes coming from the war ministry in Berlin? Anthony Fokker, being a foreigner, not speaking German very well, he had a different idea. He considered the pilots to be his customers. That was a revolutionary idea. Nobody else thought of that.
Yeah.
But he really saw the pilots that operated his aircraft at the front as his prime customers. And there are remnants of correspondence left between people flying his airplanes at the front, writing back to Anthony Fokker at the factory in Schwerin and commenting on various flying characteristics of his aircraft. And they really saw, the pilots saw themselves as customers. They came to him, and when they were off duty, Anthony Fokker celebrated all his pilot friends, and the booze flowed liberally, and the girl. You know, girls were always around.
Yeah, yeah. So, and he was becoming an extremely affluent individual as a result of this, and as a result of selling all these aircraft to the German ministry. But to be fair to him, he made sure his workers were looked after as well, because, as you said, things were pretty tough, weren't they, particularly towards the end of the war. But he did pay his workers good wages. He had some troubles in some of his factories, but he tried to do the right thing, didn't he?
Yeah, surprisingly, because he's not really known for his social behavior, but certainly during the wartime period, he paid his employees fair wages, above average, to be frank, and that of course also kept labor unrest at a distance. So that was a bit of, you know, that was clearly in his own interest. But
yeah. And the end of the war saw Anthony get into a little bit of a corner. His wealth was predominantly built in Germany. He recognized that he couldn't stay there, but his aircraft got caught up in the armistice agreement as well. And all this became a very complicated situation. Tell us how he managed to get himself out of Germany and get his money out and become, in effect, a Dutch citizen again.
Well, that's a strange story in itself. By the time the war ended in November 1918, the Allies had learned to fear Fokker's latest fighter aircraft that were in the skies, the D-7. It's a biplane.
Yeah.
And it was the first Fokker fighter that had proper engines, Mercedes engines, that were much more reliable than the earlier Fokker models had. And that plane was considered by the Allies as a fearsome aircraft. And it was mentioned in even in Article 4 of the Armistice Agreement that all aircraft of the type Fokker D-7 had to be turned over to the Allies forthwith. And that, of course, it should have spelled trouble for Fokker immediately, but it took him about a month to realize that this was not commercially handy for him, like recognition by the opposite side of, wow, what a great product this Fokker company is turning out, but that this was actually a sort of a bell tolling. Well, we're not going to allow the Fokker company to keep operating. So in the closing months of 1918, as Germany was engulfed by social unrest and there was a revolution in the streets everywhere, and Anthony Fokker, who had no interest in politics to begin with, was at once cornered by the developments in German society, saw the Allies sort of singling him out as an aircraft producer that would not be allowed to continue in the post-war sphere, and was advised, well, why don't you do what others do? Why don't you cross the border? There are all these neutral countries. There's Switzerland, there's Denmark, there's Russia. And other German aircraft producers also moved part of their equipment across the border. And Fokker was advised by the war ministry in Berlin that this would be something that the Germans would really appreciate if he did that, provided that at some point in the then distant future, they could call upon him, you know, to honor his debt.
Yes. Yeah, well, he did escape, though, didn't he? He got his money out. He
got his money out.
He literally got his money out in hard currency, didn't he? It's quite an interesting little story.
Yeah, that's a very bizarre story. I found it in a letter from one of his business associates, Friedrich
They escaped in the...
Seekatz describes how a bunch of people associated with Fokker are hunched together in the living room of an aunt of his German fiancée in Berlin, stacking money on the carpet because it was prohibited by law in Germany to export currencies after the war, but of course everybody who had any sort of access to large-scale funding tried to do so no matter what. Anthony Fokker was one of them, and his friends packed this huge pile of paper, money in various currencies, shares, all kinds of value-containing paper into the carpet, put the carpet in the back of his or the back seat of his car, and he drove the car from Berlin to Travemünde on the east on the Baltic, and instructed the captain of his yacht, Captain August, to set sail immediately and try to escape the British blockades and set sail for Holland with his fortune.
Yeah.
Nobody knows exactly how much, but his own estimate is that he managed to save about 34 million marks from his German accounts. And his accounts had about 88 million marks.
Wow.
By his own estimate at the end of the war. So slightly less than half was transported out, and Captain August, who could have, of course, turned right and sailed to Helsinki or Sweden and lived very comfortably forever after, in the end, he did manage to dock his yacht in Den Helder in the Netherlands, where Anthony Fokker had been anxiously waiting for weeks.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story, and hearing how he himself got out is interesting. But in the meantime, he managed to get himself married and started setting up business in Holland, challenging, because predominantly he was known for his work in Germany. It wasn't too popular for him to bring his German designs and manufacturing to Holland. But in true Anthony Fokker fashion, he managed to convince KLM in particular, but the Dutch government, to buy his aircraft.
Yeah, well, the thing was that Holland had remained neutral during the war. But the country did not have its own aeronautical industry. And whereas all the warring factions were putting aircraft in the sky, we had none. Well, we had some, about 30. But they were sort of what the French had not wanted to use in 1914 that was exported to Holland. And the government had, during the war, been trying to encourage aeronautical construction in this country, but had been relatively unsuccessful in doing so because the technological know-how was just lacking. And there, in 1918, early 1919, there's suddenly somebody who's crossing the border with four trainloads of ultra-modern fighter aircraft on them, like 220, complete air force arrives. And the government, who was initially very much interested in buying this air force and operating it, and then discovered, wait a minute, the war's ended. We don't need 200 fighter aircraft.
Yeah.
Why not buy 20? No, we'll have something of an air force, a semblance of an air force. But Anthony Fokker was very frustrated about this because his large-scale order of 200 planes that he hoped to deliver was reduced to about 20. And that spelled that his interest in his newly founded Dutch company very quickly waned because he discovered that this is not really a market.
Yeah.
But
he was quite visionary, and he saw the opportunity for passenger transport very early, didn't he? And he was able to, I suppose, switch over into design and development of airliners. He saw that as an opportunity very quickly to sell to them what was the fledgling KLM.
Yeah, and the story of his life continues here, because the invention of the airliner is not really his either. It was invented in Schwerin, where his factory had been or is still operating on a shoestring basis. And there, the people who were working there, he had about 600 people still working for him in 1919 in Germany. They came up with the idea that maybe if you'd have a large reconnaissance airplane, there might be just enough room in such a plane to take on passengers. And if they couldn't build warplanes anymore, maybe they could build passenger planes. And Anthony Fokker imported his first aircraft from his German factory, sold it to the new airline that had just been founded in Holland in 1919, KLM, and then got into a terrible fight with the KLM management when they found out that what they had bought were not Dutch planes. No, they were German planes.
Yeah. Yeah, I having read the book and the accounts, I was quite flabbergasted as I read through these steps that he took. He was so persistent in driving his business and his aircraft forward that A, he lost sight again of his personal life, and his marriage broke down. But he kept on driving on, didn't he? He kept on pushing the Dutch government. He kept pushing KLM to develop and buy new aircraft, even though it was very clear that I suppose the saying is he was pushing water uphill.
Yeah, he was. But he was successful in doing that. And everybody believed in Holland at that point that it was something very important, and that promoting civil air transport and building airliners was the prime business of the Fokker company.
Yeah.
Little did they know that Fokker had a subsidiary company in Holland, in the southwestern provinces where his family came from. And they there built fighter aircraft for the Russian army. They built about 300 ultra-modern fighters that equipped the Soviet Air Force.
Yeah.
which was something that nobody in Holland knew.
Yeah. He was amazing. And again, both from his business perspective and his networking perspective, he was connected to the royal family, wasn't he? And that helped him a great deal.
Yeah. That what was through his through the time that he operated in Schwerin in northern Germany. Schwerin was ruled by a Grand Duke, Franz Ferdinand. And Franz Ferdinand's brother, Heinrich, or Hendrik, as we say in Holland, married the Dutch queen. It does not make you king. You're having the title of prince consort in the Netherlands. But it through his association with Schwerin, with the ruling family there, he knew Prince Heinrich. Both from his German times and afterwards from his Dutch time. In fact, the prince, who had rather a keen interest in boys and girls of all kinds of ages, rented rooms above Fokker's company management in Amsterdam. So they were very closely associated.
Yes.
And that helped him a great deal.
Yeah, that I'd forgotten that little note.
Listen, I haven't got long. It's about The Aviation Historian, the magazine the mainstream monthlies don't want you to know about. It's a new compact format quarterly journal, exploring the less well-known paths of flying history. It's created by experienced, award-winning former Aeroplane magazine editors Mick Oakey and Nick Stroud. It's not in the shops, but you can get it via the website, theaviationhistorian.com.
Oi, we know you're in there!
They're coming for me. I've got to go. Remember, The Aviation Historian.
He continued to drive his military as well as his civilian aircraft designs and aircraft manufacture, but he was making enemies. He was popular. He was almost a heroic figure in a lot of people's eyes, but he was also making enemies both in business and nationally, and particularly the French, turning up to the Paris Air Show with aircraft built in Germany in 1920 wasn't a very clever move, and that earned him some real enemies in the French, didn't it?
Oh, absolutely. He was surprised. That you'd think that after four years of being at war with the French, you would sort of have an inkling that, oh, maybe I'm not going to be liked there. But Anthony Fokker, being so much preoccupied with flight, with aviation, had completely disinterest in the whole political business around it, had not really worked it out that if there'd be a large aeronautical exhibition in France in the post-war years, that somebody with German roots would not be welcome there, maybe. And he was really surprised when the crowd cornered him and attacked him, and he had to be rescued by the French police and was given in instructions to disappear as quickly as he possibly could.
And in true Anthony Fokker fashion, both his visionary his vision for the future started to come out, but also he had his eye on the USA by this time. He recognized that it would offer him great reward. But he was very visionary. He predicted metal aircraft would cross the Atlantic in less than a day, and this was in 1920.
Yeah, he was a visionary guy. When he first arrived in America, he was welcomed as the magician of aircraft construction, finally having arrived to the United States.
And one thing, Mark, that I forgot to ask you earlier and forgot to mention, the one thing about Anthony Fokker, and we talked about how passionate he was about flying, was that he tested every single one of his aircraft, didn't he? He wanted to be the first person to fly it and to test it.
Well, he didn't just want it to be, but it was in some cases it was also a requirement that was stipulated in the sales agreements for his aircraft. Of course, as I've tried to explain, Anthony Fokker was what is of course known as an airplane constructor, but was really predominantly a pilot.
Yeah,
and he was a test pilot par excellence. He could fly an airplane and immediately sense what was wrong with it, where it had to be changed, what had to be changed to improve the flight characteristics, and that was really one of his gifts.
It certainly was a talent, wasn't it? And he amazingly could pick out those tiny details. Let's talk then about the early 20s. He crisscrossed the Atlantic. Oh, I read so many times in the book how many times he crossed the Atlantic, but he built a strong network. He was very credible, and he started to try and sell to the US Ministry of Defense, didn't he?
Yeah, in April 1919, when he was still in Amsterdam, trying to adapt to Dutch life. He was visited by two American spies, and they came with a message from Washington that it might be very profitable for his career if he could move over to the United States. And they didn't have to say it twice to him. Although his English was not very good, he got that message.
Yeah.
And from late 1920 onwards, he's really putting all his effort and all his energy into setting up business in the United States, and which is strange because we in Holland think of Anthony Fokker as a Dutchman and as an aeronautical constructor in this country, but really what he was for himself, his Dutch phase was a transitory phase. It was just a sort of intermediate thing to get set up in the United States, where there were, well, the proverbial unlimited possibilities.
Yeah, and passenger transport was starting to creep into the US at this time. And again, in true visionary fashion, he saw an opportunity there to design and build aircraft, didn't he?
Yeah. He had, and it did take him a long time because, you know, without skills in the English language and with the enormous distances of the time, it was of course difficult to organize a corporate activity on another continent. That is still something of a problem for modern day businesses. So it took him a couple years, but he did envision that eventually in this very large country there had to be something like an air transport system. It was just and he saw that very, very clearly, and in all kinds of public lectures with which he toured the United States, he kept stipulating time and again that this country will have, within our lifetime, within the next decennium, will have its own air transportation system. And of course, he was very right in that. And he was getting really to making sure that he would build the aircraft to operate it.
Yeah. And I didn't get any impression from the story that wasn't something that was original to Anthony Fokker either. This certainly was something that he was very passionate about. He could see this unfolding in front of him. He could see some of the other US designs as well, didn't he? And his luck turned in 1923 when his F-4 transport aircraft crossed the continent.
Yeah, yeah. Another strange story to be true. The plane was built in Holland, in the factory that he'd set up to build fighter aircraft for the Russians. But they had a sort of a secondary activity there, and that was building planes for the Americans. And he exported a couple of then large transport aircraft to the United States, and they were used in 1920. One of them was used in 1923 to make the first nonstop crossing across the continental U.S. It's still preserved in the National Air and Space Museum in Washington to this very day.
Yeah.
But the American military, which operated the aircraft, of course, for publicity reasons, did not want to acknowledge that this was a foreign-built machine. They stressed in all press messages and all the newspapers that reported on it that the United States Army Air Service had made this gigantic technological leap and had now flown from coast to coast in a plane.
Yeah.
And nobody mentioned there was a Fokker plane.
Yeah.
He was very frustrated about that.
But he was very famous at this point, wasn't he? He was an international celebrity.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And sadly, his personal life saw tragedy as well when his wife, Violet, very tragically took her own life. And this had quite a strong effect on Anthony Fokker, didn't it?
That had a tremendous effect on it. In fact, the suicide of his second wife was really the turning point in his private and in his professional life. He met her in 1926 at a party. Probably, we don't know exactly. They married in March 1927, but Anthony Fokker, being himself, was not one for marriage. He would go out of the house, and you would not have any clue whether he was going to come back today, tomorrow, this week, this month, or in 5 months' time. You just didn't know.
Yeah.
And his wife, after her first year of marriage, started developing symptoms that we would now call depression, very serious depression.
Yeah.
And she recognized the symptoms, was hospitalized for them. And when she came out of the hospital on February the 8th, 1929, Anthony Fokker was not there to collect her, which was a major disappointment, I think, if you've been in the hospital for many weeks. He, instead of collecting her, he sent his driver. And the driver took her to their apartment on the Riverside Drive in New York City, where they occupied a luxury apartment. And in the apartment, nobody knew where Anthony Fokker was either, because he'd left that morning to go to his factory in Teterboro, that's just across the Hudson River from New York City. And he'd taken off on a test flight of an F-10 airline. It's a trimotor airplane. And nobody knew where he was or whether he actually was going to come back at all. So the women in the apartment, Violet and the house staff, then decide to cook a reunification dinner. And the dinner gets ready, and still Anthony Fokker doesn't show up, and it gets later and later. The dinner goes stale. And finally he comes in, and he walks into this hallway of the apartment, and I've been there. It's not very large, and Violet is there in the hallway, and we have a witness statement to that effect. And he pretends he doesn't even see her. He just walks straight past her into the bedroom, collapses on the bed, and announces, "I'm tired. I'm going to sleep." And then this scene develops. Violet follows him into the bedroom. "Come on, Anthony. You know, we haven't spoken for weeks. I've been in hospital. I've not been feeling well. Talk to me." But when he's in such a mood, there's no talking to him. So he pretends to be asleep, and then she has the maid carry the food into the bedroom and put it on the side table. Come on, at least let's eat something. But no, nothing, nothing, nothing. And then she decides, well, maybe I should go to bed as well. And when she is in her nightgown in the open window, it's cold in New York. It's snowing on that particular night. She must have realized suddenly, this is my life. Yeah. It's not going to get better. I'm married to somebody who does not recognize me as a person, who does not recognize my needs, my need for love.
Yeah.
And in that desperation, and with this depression pressing on her, she jumps out of the window from the 15th floor.
Mm.
And it's only after she's done that, and Anthony Fokker's sort of shaken by the house staff. Mr. Fokker, your wife. And the signal sounds from down below where the police find the body of the suicide victim. It's only then that he realizes, my God, what a bastard am I.
Yeah.
This is all my doing.
Yeah.
And he then suffers from a complete mental and physical collapse. And he completely loses interest in everything that's connected to his business, which had made up his entire life until that moment.
And it, particularly at that point as well, his US business was growing dramatically. As I mentioned earlier, he was a celebrity. He had aircraft being designed to fly from California to Australia. But if I can go back, Mark, just a little bit, tell me about his other relationship that seemed to be quite influential with Richard Byrd.
That's another great story. In the mid-1920s, there's this kind of race developing in the United States, being the first to fly nonstop across the Atlantic. And there's a substantial bit of prize money involved. But really, it's the honor that people are after. And so I think about 8 pilots lose their life in attempts to cross the Atlantic. And Fokker decides they're all going about this in the wrong way. We need a large, reliable plane, a multi-engine plane with enough fuel to do that. And we will clear the job. And Fokker's business partners in this event invest about $150,000 into a venture that will get a Fokker airplane to be the first to cross the Atlantic. And the American naval commander, Richard Byrd, is going to be the navigator for that flight and also the commander of the airplane. The year before, Byrd had flown another Fokker plane as the first, at least Byrd claimed, across the North Pole. But the aircraft crashes on a test flight. Bizarre fluke accident, really. Anthony Fokker's at the controls. He's landing the plane. The whole crew that's going to fly across the Atlantic is in the plane. And Fokker realizes, my God, the weight distribution is wrong.
Yeah.
Because we've built in this large central fuel tank where the passenger cabin would normally be. But the fuel tank is empty, and that makes the plane the tail of the plane gets up continuously.
Yeah.
So he warns the crew to go as far aft as they can possibly go, but the co-pilot doesn't want to leave the co-pilot's seat because he'll have to climb across this large fuel tank. And he doesn't feel comfortable with not being in the cockpit. Then the plane lands, and sure enough, the tail pushes up, and the central propeller hits the ground, and the plane somersaults. Nowadays, this would be a complete, utter, and immediate write-off.
Yeah.
But in 1927, not so. The plane, Fokker recognizes, yes, the plane's wrecked. Of course, everything's broken, but we can mend it. We can weld it together again.
Yeah.
And they start doing that. But they take so long. And Richard Byrd, who has broken his wrist in the this plane crash, is not very keen on flying the aircraft across the Atlantic all of a sudden.
No.
And exactly at the day, the 20th of May 1927, when the big Fokker contender for this transatlantic race will be baptized and christened the America, precisely at that day, a then almost unknown airmail pilot, Charles Lindbergh, takes off from the same airfield where everything is getting is brought in readiness to celebrate the christening of the large Fokker plane. And of course, Lindbergh, who'd applied to Fokker before this eventful flight, can I buy an aircraft from you? And they, the Fokker people said, oh, you don't have any money.
Yeah.
Bye. Of course, Lindbergh makes it as the first across the Atlantic. And the story gets worse because finally, after a month of further delays, when Byrd is ready to fly as the second flight nonstop to Paris, just about everything that can go wrong with this flight goes wrong. They can't find Paris. Can
yeah,
you imagine?
Because they get across the Atlantic, don't they? They actually
get across
make
the Atlantic.
It. Yeah.
They circle and circle and circle, but they can't find Paris. There's clouds over Paris, and they can't find the airport. And they circle and circle until finally the fuel runs low, and the pilot says, well, we have to do something. You know, either we're going to crash here, or maybe we can all survive if we find water to make a crash landing on. But they fly back to the French coast and land the plane just off the coast. And unfortunately, this Fokker plane had, being the second, you know, there's not going to be the honors that Lindbergh had, but they were the first to carry an official shipment of mail across the Atlantic, the first airmail ever sent to Europe. But of course, in the crash landing, the plane gets wet, the mail sack gets wet, it floats off into the ocean, and all the mail's lost. So it's a complete and utter failure.
Yeah, a disaster.
And never spoke to each other again.
G'day, I'm Dave Homewood of the Wings Over New Zealand show, New Zealand's only regular aviation podcast series. The Wings Over New Zealand show covers all sorts of aviation topics, with a New Zealand flavour but an international appeal. From interviews with veterans and aviation personalities, to topics like military aviation, warbirds, air shows, historians, authors, museums, aviation events, and much, much more. We have an extensive archive of episodes that you can go back to, and there are new episodes coming out all the time. Search for the Wings Over New Zealand show. Oh, and by the way, we love Extended. It's a great show. Well done, guys.
Around this time, he had a new factory in Glendale. He successfully had an aircraft fly from California to Australia. But the loss of Violet and his partners in General Motors all started, the course and the tide started to flow against him, didn't he? He lost his seat on the board of his own company, and things started to go very tricky for him.
Yeah, well, General Motors came in April 1929 as a sort of a corporate investment. And there was a lot of corporate investment in aviation at that point.
Mm.
And General Motors was really late in finding a suitable target to invest in. But it was only after they invested about $7 million into the Fokker company that they found out that the technology employed at the Fokker company was not sort of state-of-the-art technology, even in 1929. It was getting behind in all kinds of aspects. And they wanted to get new designers and new know-how on board of the Fokker company, which was then still the largest aeronautical corporation in the United States, mind you.
Yeah.
And they went across the Atlantic. They shipped around, and they walked and they toured around in Germany, in France, in the United States, hiring engineers who might be able to push the company into adapting all kinds of new aeronautical construction technologies. But Fokker himself. Yeah, he was not. This is not a technological man, and he was.
Yeah,
he had assumed the position of director of technologies in this new company that was run by General Motors, and the General Motors management realized, my God, we've invested a large sum of money into a company that of which the technology is run by somebody who is really not technologically educated at all.
Yeah.
And we need to get rid of him.
And his
The end he was ousted. Yeah.
Yeah, and his health was starting to suffer as well. That he suffered from sinus problems, didn't he, because of those very early flying years that he had, pushing all the boundaries. He started to get unwell, but I suppose the end of the dream of manufacturing under the Fokker brand in the US started to come to the horizon when another crash of one of his aircraft hit the news, and that was the F-10A with the famous football player on board.
Yeah, that's right. Well, Fokker was chased by bad luck after bad decisions.
Hmm.
The company had invested all of its future into the construction of a large airliner, the jumbo jet of its age, the Fokker F-32, very large four-engine plane, kind of the size of a Douglas DC-10, really large aircraft. But there was not really a market for such large aircraft because they were prohibitively expensive, and after 1929, the money dried up.
Yeah.
So rather than buying a $110,000 airliner, small airline companies that were still emerging in the United States were seeking smaller aircraft that were less expensive. Fokker also built smaller aircraft, the F-10A, and that for a while appeared to become the backbone of the American airline system. But unfortunately, the F-10A suffered from problems that Fokker's airplanes had suffered from in the First World War as well. It was built in West Virginia in a new production factory where they'd hired local wood workers, and they had the same kind of problems in working in wood and attaining to these very exacting standards that you need to have in aeronautical construction. And the effect was that the wings of these airplanes suffered from flutter. The wing tips, if they were really rough at atmospheric conditions, they would go up and down, up and down, up and down, and it would make the airplane extremely difficult to fly. This was not typical for the F-10A because there are reports in Holland from pilots flying to the Dutch East Indies on Dutch-built Fokker planes that report the same problem. Unfortunately for Fokker, none of the Dutch planes ever went down, and only one of the F-10As in the United States went down. Why, we don't know exactly, but unfortunately for Fokker, there was the famous football coach Newt Rockne was on board of the aircraft, and because of this national celebrity Rockne being killed in the crash, there was all kinds of media attention focused on this particular airplane crash, and for the first time in the history of supervision of aviation in the United States, the Department of Commerce, then responsible for civil aviation technology, decided to ground all Fokker aircraft. And that suddenly spelled the end of the factory. They had the large F-32 airplane that nobody wanted to buy. They had the smaller F-10As that nobody could operate anymore. And then, of course, Fokker's days were numbered.
Yeah, but out of adversary, and you know this comes through the Fokker story several times, he sees an opportunity, and he sees the opportunity to, I suppose, what I would describe as become an agent for other aircraft manufacturers in Europe, because he's looking to spend a bit more time back in Europe, in Holland. He still has his relationships, particularly with airlines like KLM, and he saw the opportunity to become an agent, didn't he? And quite successfully.
Yeah, Fokker was maybe not a great businessman, but he was a very keen salesman. And in November 1933, there is a kind of a conflict, one in a long series between Anthony Fokker and the KLM manager Albert Plessman.
Yeah.
And that is settled when Plessman indicates to Fokker, well, I may not be as interested anymore in buying your aircraft as I used to be. Because Plessman had heard that in the United States there was this new revolutionary airliner, the Douglas DC-1 and or later the DC-2, developed by putting hundreds of thousands of dollars into research and development, made possible by the influx of this large capital in the 1920s that we talked about. And that enabled a completely different kind of airplane to be developed. Not one that was built by hand, but one that was built to a certain standard procedure for which you needed machinery and tools, and which made that every airplane was exactly the same as the airplane before it, on the construction line and the airplane following it. That was something that Fokker didn't do. You could, in the Fokker company, you build customized planes.
Yeah.
And these new airplanes, airliners, were, and I think Albert Plessman was right in recognizing that, they held the promise of the future. And Fokker, talking to Plessman, realized, my God, you know, they've come to a point in time and they will probably want to have this new airliner. And he says, well, you know, let's talk about this. And Plessman says, well, you may be able to help me actually in this matter, because KLM, now of course a company operating across the world, was in 1933 a very Dutch national company that was operating within the boundaries of a very small country and had very little international contacts to speak of, let alone in the American aeronautical industry. And there was this well-known world celebrity constructor who crossed the Atlantic 3-4 times a year, who said, well, okay, if you want to buy these American planes, I may be able to help you. You know, I've been shipping aircraft across the Atlantic for 15 years now. And Fokker got on, yeah, to make a long story short, Fokker got on the next ship to the United States, traveled to California, got together with the management of the Douglas and the Lockheed aircraft construction companies, and managed for a very moderate price, because they were very American companies operating within the American confines, for a very moderate price was able to buy the manufacturing license and sales rights of the Douglas and Lockheed airliners for Europe. For, well, I think if I remember correctly, about $15,000, less than the price of a single plane.
Yeah, but he then had an extraordinary markup on those aircraft, didn't he?
He made
substantial profits on the sales that he proposed.
Yeah. And of course, he antagonized all his business partners in Europe again and again and again. And but, you know, because he had the rights, so he could do as he pleased with them.
Yeah, and there is a fascinating story where he gets caught out as well in the book, which I'll leave for the listeners to read when they get a copy of the book. It is really fascinating to see how he did that. But Mark, I suppose coming to the conclusion that I draw from the book and the title of the book. Is this really where you get the title from, The Flying Dutchman Who Shaped American Aviation? Tell us why you use that line.
I use that line because in the 1920s, Anthony Fokker was invited to the United States in order to bring the American aeronautical industry to a higher level. And until the late 1920s, this was really exactly what he was doing in the United States. Then, of course, when this transatlantic adventure, which should have brought him world fame and a place in the history books, came to no success, and he lost the control of his company later on, he managed to get a second attempt in promoting aeronautics worldwide by selling Douglas and Lockheed planes. So in that sense, he was really he came to the United States to shape the American aviation industry with his own planes, and in the end, what he really and I think that was his lasting success. What he did in the end was shape the American aviation industry into a worldwide operating conglomerate.
And very successfully so. Sadly, Anthony did succumb to the sinus problems that he had, and it's very sad how he did actually pass away. But Mark, as we wrap up, what I'd like to ask you is a little bit about, and it's not to do with the book really. You know so much about Fokker; it's a strong brand even today. What's the lasting legacy of Anthony Fokker?
Oh, that's a tough question. The lasting legacy.
Because the name still... I went to a conference recently and I saw the brand, the Fokker brand. I saw it in publications recently. It's recognisable. It's identifiable, but it's no longer manufacturing, is it?
They're manufacturing still. Well, that's a complicated story. When Anthony Fokker died, the company more or less died with him. But then the Second World War came around, and the government revived the company with government money after 1946. And that was really sort of a second Fokker company, which had very little to do with the pre-war company. And that second company was very successful in developing two-engine airliners, the Fokker F-27 yep. Friendships. For a long time, the most successful twin prop jet that was around.
Yeah.
Then in the late 80s or in the 1980s, the company decided that they wanted to change focus. Rather than building small prop jet airliners for markets outside Europe, they decided to go into a completely new direction and develop new, much larger jet airliners for the European and American air transport markets. And that was a very fateful decision because the company did not have the money to market the planes because they were competing against Boeing, against Airbus. They just didn't have the money and they couldn't offer the sort of financial deals which are usual in the airline and aircraft industry businesses. And that's how the company in 1996 went bankrupt in the end. And from the bankruptcy, several segments of the Fokker company were reinstated after the bankruptcy proceedings. And exactly those parts of the company that did not build complete aircraft, which was the aim of the Fokker company proper. What are we in business for? We build aircraft. We're not an aeronautical industry. We are an aircraft industry.
Yeah.
And it's the parts of the Fokker company that were aeronautical industries, building components. They were the parts that survived to this day and are very successful. I think they employ about 3,000 to 4,000 people still in this country, building midsection fuselage for various Airbus airliners.
Wow. Okay. I didn't know that, actually. Shame on me. I didn't know that.
Yeah, that was a different book.
Well, I certainly look forward to reading more of your books now. Mark, Anthony Fokker, The Flying Dutchman Who Shaped American Aviation. It's published by Smithsonian Books. It's a lovely book. It's a proper book. It's well printed. It's nice quality. Great photographs. About 400 pages. Highly recommended. Where can we find out about the book and you online?
I know for sure that the book can be ordered through Amazon.com. So yeah. You can order it wherever you are physically located in the world.
And we'll put links to that in the show notes. Can we find you on social media anywhere, Mark?
I'm not a great one for social media. I'm a researcher with the Royal Academy in Holland, and that's not really encouraged too much. I'm on LinkedIn, but that's about it.
Okay. Well, listen, what we'll do is we'll put some links to your books in with the show notes when the show goes out, and we'll also put links into some of your other books as well. Mark, it's been an absolutely fascinating discussion. I know so much more about the enigma that is Anthony Fokker now. I've really enjoyed our chat this evening. Thank you very much.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about this almost lifelong fascination that I've had for this very strange man.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
Mark stayed on the line after we'd finished the interview and had some news for us, an extended exclusive. He also had a question for me, so find out a little bit more about my background and why my name's spelt with an I and not just an E.
Oh, yeah. Actually, Peter, there's one last bit that I forgot to mention, which might also be interesting for the listeners to know. This is the first book that I've written in a long series on aviation, of which I've sold the film rights.
Ah, okay. Okay, now that makes it interesting. Wow, yeah. That's interesting.
There's a Dutch subsidiary of Warner Brothers that is getting ready to make a full-length feature film out of it.
That must be exciting.
Oh, that is exciting, absolutely. Yeah. I can't wait. Well, unfortunately, I have waited for over 2 years, but now the latest news is that it's actually going to be made. So I thought that might be nice to mention that.
Thank you very much. That's an exclusive for us. But the book's great. I really, really enjoyed it. I found it hard to put down because he's such an interesting character. So I really appreciate the opportunity to read it and then to talk to you. Well, it's been fantastic talking to you. Thank you so much for giving up your Friday evening.
Well,
I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Peter. I actually, that's one thing that I want to ask you as well.
Yeah.
your first name, Peter,
is sort of
the Dutch spelling for for Peter. So do you have some kind of Dutch connection somewhere?
Yeah, there is. I'm half Dutch. My mother is Dutch, Kortenhoef.
Oh, yeah, I know where that is.
And then brought up in Den Helder. My grandfather was a commander in the Dutch Navy. Interestingly enough, a little after, but over in the Dutch East Indies, just before, in between the wars, my mother met my father in 46, 47. She's an artist. He was traveling with a dancing group, and they met in Paris, and she's, been in the UK almost ever since, but she's very Dutch. All of our Dutch family came over 2 weeks ago to celebrate her 90th birthday. So, So Holland is very much in my blood, and that's why makes this just a bit more special for me.
I understand completely now. Because I was really wondering, I thought, well, Peter, with that spelling, that has to be a Dutch connection.
Yeah. Well, sometimes we get publishers write to us, and sometimes it's right, and sometimes it's not for them or for us. But when Leah dropped me a line, I thought, do you know what? This one is for us.
Yeah, that would be fitting. Yeah.
So I'm excited. I have no idea what sort of feedback we'll get, but this is very different. We've not covered anything from this time in history, to my knowledge, for some time. So it's unique. So I'm very, very keen to see how well it goes down, and I will of course let you know.
Okay, wonderful. I'll be looking out for that, keeping my fingers crossed.
Yeah, excellent. Well, listen, Mark, it's fantastic to talk to you. Thank you so much for your time. I really, really appreciate it. I've really enjoyed it.
Well, the enjoyment was on both ends of,
the line.
So thank you for the opportunity to talk about my academic hobby. That's always great.
He's amazing. You've done a fantastic job. Well done.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, that's it for this episode. We're extremely keen to get some feedback to Mark on this interview, so please do get in touch on social media or through email, and we will forward that on to Mark, of course. We have a Facebook page and a Twitter feed. Look out for Aviation Extended. That's all one word. We really do get a great deal from your feedback. It helps us and our guests, so please do get in touch. We'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions to the show. You can find Extended now on all major podcast players. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website, so please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme is produced with a Creative Commons licence. You can find me, Nascot Hornet, on Twitter. You can find Tim Robinson at R-A-E-S, Tim R, on Twitter. And you can follow Gareth Stringer at Gareth_Stringer on Twitter as well. So that's it. With the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme.
The cockpit's very cramped, you've got leg restraints on, you're sat on a seat that's got explosives in it.
Just taking me on the trip of a lifetime in a F-18F Super Hornet.
Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need.
This is XTP Media.